You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Eagles, not in studio today. We continue. A couple of emails. Here's an interesting one. Mac, do you think you could work for Donald Trump? You know, I work for people. It's hard, you know. Probably the worst guy I ever worked for was right towards the end of my career. He's one of those guys who crushes the life and inspiration out of an organization, micromanages everything, and is an idiot on top of it all. So, could I work for Donald Trump? How much money am I getting paid? Maybe. Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But there would come a point after I did it for a while where I probably would say I can't do this anymore. When he consistently undercuts you in public with his stupidity, and he's got a bunch of it going on. Right? Which tells you, you know, how frustrated the nation was to elect him. I think there's a lot of people that believe that we need to do something about the southern border. Most Americans will tell you that's a problem. You know, the whole build a wall thing. I think for the majority of those people who think something ought to be done is a figure of speech, and that means secure the border. The wall, I'll leave that up to the people that work down there. But make that number of people coming into the country illegally, make that go down. And the closer to zero you can make that, the better. Understanding that zero is not achievable. Okay, America first, make America great again. How do those not resonate with people? I think a lot of people see that we get, you know, taken to the shed in a lot of the deals that we put together. So could I work for Donald Trump? In the short term, yes. In the long term, probably not. I'd probably become discouraged, disillusioned, and then at some point something would happen in public and I would say, yeah, I can't do this anymore. And trust me, if he loses, the two guys that he cannot afford to have that happen with are the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense. Those are the two guys that he cannot afford in any way, shape, or form to have guys of that stature leave the administration. So, anyway, it is the challenge of Donald Trump. He and that Twitter account. And so it goes. Anyway, and now you got Steve Bannon on the outside now, running his little, reign of terror. So, anyway, so it goes. So it goes. The schedule for Major League Baseball tonight, if you're following the playoffs, and you should be. Baseball is a great sport, and you should follow the playoffs. So tonight, the Colorado Rockies and the Arizona Diamondbacks play at 5 o'clock Pacific time, and they're on TBS. John Gray versus Zach Greinke. There's still tickets available, too. Starting at $27, you can get a ticket to go to the game tonight. Yankees in Cleveland game on, let's see, when are they playing? Wednesday? Thursday. Tickets for that series start at $110. There's 120 tickets left. In every other series, there's thousands of tickets left. For instance, Red Sox at Houston, there's 4,000 tickets left for that game in Houston, starting at $24. Yankees at Cleveland, there's 120 tickets left at $110 a shot. The game on Friday, Yankees-Cleveland, there's 100 tickets left for that, starting at $130. So, anyway, playoff baseball, awesome. Somebody sent me an email earlier and asked, did all three of those teams come out of the Pacific? And I said yes, but I double-checked it. And, yeah, all three of those teams came out of the Pacific Division of Major League Baseball, out of the West Division of Major League Baseball, the National League. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. So, again, of the 5 teams in the postseason in the National League, three of the five teams come from one division, which tells you a little bit about the Western Division of the National League. Another email. I think I could work for Trump. The money's good. Hell, I put up with bigger assholes for less money. I could certainly deal with him. Mac, you're being a bit of a wuss. You know, maybe I am. Maybe I am being a bit of a wuss. But I am what I am. No, what happens is, His Twitter admonition of the Secretary of State, Rex, don't waste your time, blah, 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 that tweet. I mean, that's really nonsense, right? That's not going to deter Tillerson from doing his job. It may make it a bit more complicated, but, you know, it's easily explained. Hey, it's what he does. He's as ridiculous as your guy, okay? So let's get past that and let's get to business. Oh, okay. But when he comes out fundamentally and you have to change a position that you've worked and crafted for, then to me that's a different story. It's not just you adjusting and explaining like Mattis was doing yesterday. It's something fundamentally different. Okay, now speaking of Mattis, we had to interrupt the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing yesterday, so I want to finish, and it's pretty close to the end. But there's big news that came out of it. If you look, and then we'll check the news of the day, and we'll check the early bird, because much of the news out of the early bird came from this. So it's the reason I love when those kind of guys are appearing in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee, the House Armed Services Committee, to listen to them, because that's the answer, right? Everybody else will speculate on what's going on. These guys will tell you. And if you listen to it yesterday, what you found out was they are much more optimistic. They are much more optimistic about Afghanistan than I certainly would have been. I got another email. Mac, I've heard you insinuate a couple of different times about Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and the Vietnam series. Do you care to elaborate? Well, let me speak for myself here. I don't know how you can watch, as a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, I don't know how you could watch the Vietnam series and not see parallels between what happened in Vietnam and what happened in what happened in Iraq, what happened in Afghanistan. Iraq was a war we did not have to fight. Yeah, how about that? That was a war that we chose to fight based on poor intelligence and misguided human beings that were in high places in the Bush agenda, and yet other people in high places that wouldn't stand up to them, namely the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. Then you go there, and they're lying to the American people, and Don Rumsfeld. And so I think you feel uneasy about it. Is this another Vietnam? How could that happen? So the question is, so what should have happened? Well, you've heard Tony Zinni say, you go to Afghanistan, right? You go find Osama bin Laden, you jump the 82nd Airborne, which they chose not to do. You jump them into Tora Bora, and you go find the son of a bitch, and you kill him. And then you tell Afghanistan, look, we can come to this anytime we want to. If you stack two rocks on top of each other and we don't like it, we're going to come blow it away. You best get your shit together because we'll be watching. We want no part of your nasty country. Boom. And then you leave. You came, you killed the people, you destroyed the people responsible for what happened on September 11th. You put the government that harbored them on notice that if we see things we don't like, we're just going to come and destroy it. We're not going to come and take over your country because we want no part of this backward dump, okay? We're just going to destroy things. Deal with it. Out. And then leave. And then when you look at Iraq, you say no. Hey, Rumsfeld, shut up. Go away. Wolfowitz, shut up. Go away. All the rest of you neocons, shut up. Go away. We're not doing a war we don't have to do. No matter what your little neocon crystal ball says. Okay, and imagine all the money we spent on those wars, not spent. You know? Afghanistan's spinning in its own dirt orbit, all right? But not a menace to the United States. And if it was a menace, we would go back in there. We would destroy whoever threatened us. So, but nation building, that's the lesson of Vietnam. It's a bad business. It's a bad business. So how different would, you know, Saddam Hussein would still be doing his nonsense, you know, which was nothing. He was nothing. And at some point, you know, he dies, regime change, blah, 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 whatever. But the Middle East is still a relatively stable event. Yeah, pretty different, huh? Okay, Senate Armed Service Committee is wrapping up, so let me, I want to play this for you. Because it's interesting, good stuff, good information for all of us, and I enjoy it.
Throughout the country, I think they can be an incredibly important strategic partner of ours. We share...
This is Senator Sullivan. I don't know... He's a Republican. No, he's a Democrat. That's all I know about him.
Similar values, oldest, largest democracies in the world working together. Can you give me a sense, Ms. Secretary, on your recent trip, not only with regard to the importance that India could play with regard to our Afghanistan policy, but other challenges, say China's aggressive actions in the South China Sea and the rise of China, and maybe looking at India as a partner on some of those key issues where our interests align?
Well, Senator, your point about where our interests align is very, very indicative of the current situation we find ourselves in. What we have right now, Senator, is a strategic convergence, generational opportunity between the two largest democracies in the world to work together based on those shared interests of peace, of prosperity, of stability in the region. And India is coming into its own. It's going to be a global player. And I think this is quite right as Prime Minister Modi takes them forward economically to a much higher level of living for his people, to a bigger role in the world. And that role from our perspective, is a wholly positive one right now. And I think we are natural partners, India and the United States, and we recognize each other's sovereignty. We have respect for each other, but we also see the opportunity we're presented with right now.
So it's safe to say your meetings went well in India recently?
The meetings could not have gone better, Senator.
Great. Let me turn to North Korea, like a number of my colleagues. A lot of concern on that. I, for one, very much appreciate your regular briefings that you've had with this committee. I think they've been constructive. I think they're helping bring both members, Democrats and Republicans, into trying to help with regard to that policy strategy, a very challenging national security issue, as we all know. The main effort then continues to be diplomacy. I know you've been asked this a number of times, but I just want to reiterate that. Simple yes or no answer on that.
It's diplomatically led, Senator, by Secretary Tillerson. There are economic sanctions that you've seen demonstrated by the unanimous UN Security Council resolutions. How often do we find Russia, China, the United States, France, others, all voting as one? It shows the degree of acceptance that this is an international threat, and people are working together, imperfectly, but working together to try to address it. And we will continue to maintain a Department of Defense that looks toward the defense of our people and the defense of our allies, with military options on the table.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, if I may, just one final quick question on part of our strategy. It's become apparent that the President and the two of you and others have been talking about how critical missile defense is as a key element of our strategy, not just dealing with North Korea, but rogue nations like Iran. As you know, in the NDAA, we had a number of provisions to advance our nation's missile defense. I know that the administration is looking at additional measures. Could you describe those, General or Mr. Secretary, both in terms of what you want to do, how we can be supportive? I think one of the breakthroughs that you saw in the NDAA this year is missile defense is no longer a partisan issue. It's being viewed very much as a bipartisan issue, and I think that's important. I think you'll get a lot of support for what you want to be doing on missile defense. We just need to know exactly what you want to be doing to advance it in the near term, which I think we need to do more to advance it in the near term.
Senator, we've enjoyed bipartisan support up here on the Hill. You'll notice that the budget for this has increased in the out years and the years ahead. We're optimistic we'll get a budget by December that will help, but also the reprogramming approved by the Senate and the House here allowed us basically $440 million more in FY17 dollars to reprogram to get more of the ground-based interceptors, increase the number of sensors, and the emphasis in the near term is exactly where you indicated, and you'll see it reflected in the budget that we submit for your consideration in the future.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
On behalf of Chairman McCain, Senator Blumenthal, please.
Thank you very much, Senator Reid. Thank you both for your service. You've been thanked many, many times by this committee, and you certainly deserve those thanks and much more. I know you've been asked about Russian activity in Afghanistan, Mr. Secretary, and you observed that they are acting against their own self-interest. And I know also that when you visited Afghanistan last week, you criticized both Russia and Iran. Could you talk a bit about Iran's activity in Afghanistan, which seems as malevolent and potentially pernicious as Russia's?
Sir, Iran has, over many years, played a very complex role, and at times one that is hard to figure out. They've had their own diplomats killed by Taliban in the past, and yet they've also supported the Taliban at times with small amounts of money dribbled in or weapons and this sort of thing. The bottom line is I think Iran thrives where there is chaos, and you'll see that in Syria. You'll see it in Lebanon. You see it what they've tried to do in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. You see it in Yemen. And the only consistent theme I can see on Iran is they seem to go where they can create trouble and destabilize countries in their region. It's not in their best interest. We all can see that. I think an objective appraisal would say that that's not in Iran's best interest, but for some reason they insist on doing it.
Why do you think it's not in their best interest?
Because if you're looking out for the best interest of your people as a nation state, and if you're not just acting like a revolutionary cause in order to stay in power, then you want peace because you're not going to have the kind of economic advantages for your people. You're not going to have the kind of diplomatic engagements for your, with your people that represents their best interest. But I think that to those in power right now, in holding the real power in Tehran, they want to play the role of a revolutionary power to stay in power.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Secretary. I want to shift to Puerto Rico, if I may. I want to begin by expressing my thanks to the men and women under your command who are providing essential assistance in Puerto Rico. There are about 6,400 American military members there now, including members of the Connecticut National Guard, whom I saw off just a few days ago. They're deployed in relief efforts that impose considerable hardship on them and some risk as well. So I think they are to be thanked, and my hope is that there will be more of them because more are needed, as well as logistical support, helicopters, and other kinds of equipment there. The military essentially is the only potential resource and asset in Puerto Rico that can provide the transportation and restoration of power and so forth. I met yesterday with members of the Department of Defense, along with FEMA at the FEMA headquarters. A number of my colleagues and I went there at the invitation of the administrator of FEMA. And what impressed me is the, very bluntly, need for additional troops and resources there from the Department of Defense in order to fill the gap and the disconnect between the supplies that are in the ports and the airports and the people in the cities and interior that need those food, medicine, water, and other essential supplies. So I think there is an opportunity and obligation for greater Department of Defense involvement. General Dunford, you may recall when I asked you about this topic, you said, I'm quoting, "If there is more that needs to be done, I can assure you that Secretary Mattis has placed Puerto Rico as a priority for all of us, and General Robinson is in constant contact with FEMA, as well as with officials in Puerto Rico, to make sure the department is leaning forward and providing all the support they need," end quote. I hope that commitment is continuing, and I hope that the Department of Defense will have a plan going forward, because as of yesterday when I met with the FEMA officials,
arrived today or tomorrow, and as we had to reopen the airports themselves, which is part of the restraint on how many aircraft we could get in. There was a logistics effort simply to open the door for them to get in. So you bring in a few people, get things opened up, and keep expanding. But there is no lack of resources, sir. We are ready to go, even to the point that it's going to impact the deployments, perhaps, of some of these troops overseas next year, because we've interrupted their preparation. That's okay. When it's helping fellow Americans especially, although we also help some of the other small countries that were hard hit. But when it comes to helping Americans, it's all hands on deck, and we don't have a problem from volunteers from the various National Guards, and certainly every unit, every ship is leaning forward for a mission like this.
I have no question, sir, about your commitment and General Dunford's. What concerns me is that waiting for requests from the local leadership without a larger plan from the Department of Defense may create gaps or disconnects. And I hope that the president, when he's visiting today, will will ask for a plan as a result of this trip, and I know that you have a commitment to develop one.
We're in support of FEMA, sir, and that's why we pre-positioned ships and troops was so, even before they asked for it, they were ready. There wasn't a matter of calling up some people. We've continued calling up some, but we had people ready to go as fast as they were asked for.
Thank you.
Senator, one change that's taken place since we spoke last week is Lieutenant General Buchanan, who is the component commander for the Army Forces in Northern Command, arrived on the ground with a very capable staff. And when we spoke last, Secretary alluded to it, it was about opening the ports and opening the airfields. The focus now is on distribution. That's what you spoke about. It's the large stockpiles of supplies and so forth that are getting to the country, but not necessarily out to where the people are. And I can assure you that today, General Robinson's command, but more particularly General Buchanan, who's on the ground in Puerto Rico, they do have a plan to support the distribution of those supplies, and that is their focus. And then when the Secretary spoke about the comfort arriving, that'll be over 200 more hospital beds that'll be available to the people of Puerto Rico tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
On behalf of Chairman McCain, Senator Hunter, please.
I want to start by just thanking both of you for your attention on Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. It was clear early on with the radars down, in particular at all those airfields, there were certain things DOD does particularly well and needed to do in order to get those bottlenecks out of the way. So we very much appreciate that focus. I want to go back to Iran and the line of questioning that Senator King had. And start with just asking if Iran maintains its compliance with the JCPOA, but Congress votes to reimpose sanctions anyway, would we as the U.S. be in violation of our obligations under the JCPOA under that scenario?
Senator, I don't know. I'd have to look at what the conditions specifically would call for under the JCPOA and what in particular we would not be willing to do. Congress has a role to play in this that we see it as distinct but integral. In other words, we look at this problem set as having two distinct aspects, the JCPOA itself and the congressional action. And I'd have to compare the details on that, Senator.
One of the reasons why I ask is because the scenario I'm worried about is if we unilaterally withdraw from the JCPOA, I'm concerned about a scenario where Iran gets to keep its sanctions relief, but where we lose key enforcement and intelligence advantages. Is there a scenario where those things come to pass that could possibly be in our national security interest? Because if
Senator,
we're not careful, we could end up with the worst of both worlds, right?
If it's mishandled, yes, Senator, that could happen. It is, as you know, it is still under consideration in the executive branch, and a decision has not been made.
I would just urge you to consider that, because if we end up in a situation where we're not able to reinstate the sanctions that were multilateral, but we also lose our ability to effectively enforce the nuclear agreement, we've sort of lost on both sides of the ledger, and that would be a very unfortunate outcome for our national security. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to Afghanistan for a moment. I think it's clear that a very concise, clear strategy is essential, both for a positive end state in Afghanistan, but also absolutely key for our troop morale. And I think it's been challenging with a conflict that's gone on for 16 years and a positive end state in many ways still over the horizon to maintain troop morale. How do you describe troop morale in Afghanistan at the moment?
Senator, I was just there a couple days ago, and I got on board the aircraft after our last stop with Secretary General Stoltenberg. And here's an outside observer looking at the probably a dozen different forces, nation's forces, our own being dominant, of course, of the groups that he saw. And he said, you know, I'm amazed at how high the morale is, that they have such a strong sense of purpose. And I think it humbles all of us to think after 16 years. I personally landed in Afghanistan in November of 2001.
I remember.
And after 16 years, it reminds us we have a national treasure in the U.S. military, that these young patriots, young people, anyone who thinks we got a problem with the younger generation hadn't seen these lads and lasses in action. They're phenomenal. They look past the hot political rhetoric, say, give me the job, give me the authority, and let me go at it. Give me what I need. And there's a commitment out there that humbles me to this day.
I couldn't agree more with your sentiment with regard to the quality of people serving in our military today, and that's certainly been my experience both here and overseas in places like Afghanistan and, unfortunately, a number of other places as well. I want to ask, what is the current price tag for security in Afghanistan? Are we still roughly spending about $5 billion a year? General Dunford.
Senator, we're spending about $12.5 billion.
$12.5.
And $1.1 is the cost of the uplift that we've just proposed.
I think it was General Nicholson who testified at one point that roughly 10% of our total allocations were for security were picked up by the Afghan government. Should we expect to be paying that in perpetuity? Is there any end in sight? What is the limit?
Sure. Senator, where that figure comes from, there's about $500 billion a year is what it takes to sustain the Afghan forces. And international community coalition has paid about $5 billion for the Afghan forces specifically. The $12 billion was the cost of the entire operation.
I
spoke about earlier. The Afghan forces specifically is $5 billion. About $1 billion is paid by our international partners, members of NATO, and so forth. And $500 million is paid for by the Afghan government. We would expect that that figure will increase over time, and the Afghans will become more self-sufficient. Right now, the Afghans have commitments from the international community in the United States as a result of a NATO summit until 2020. And so after that, there's going to have to be a plan for sustaining the Afghan security forces.
Thank you very. Thank you both.
On behalf of the chairman, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, gentlemen. And I certainly want to echo, it took the United States military getting into Puerto Rico. And you all are doing the job. If you could, for me, just clarify the numbers. We called the Pentagon last night. They said 1,100 in Puerto Rico. We called the National Guard last night. They said 3,300. And you have just said 10,000. So some clarification on the numbers would be most appreciated. But the fact is that you're doing the job, and it's too bad that it took until late last week to get General Buchanan in place, because once he got in place, things started to improve. So thank you very much for that. So just at your convenience, General Dunford, give us some clarity on the numbers. If you have them now, fine. Senator,
we do. Secretary Mattis and I both have the numbers. We do have over 10,000 on the ground right now. That's about just short of 4,000 in the active component and almost 7,000 members of the National Guard. And that includes all the troops that are currently supporting both operations in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. As you know, because of the multiple storms happening in sequence, we don't have forces specifically assigned, but they're providing support throughout the area.
Okay. That's clearly the step in the right direction. I give you all the accolades that you are due, because that's what it took to get the distribution out into the interior of the island. Since the purpose of this hearing is Afghanistan, I wanted to ask you, Pakistan is sometimes friendly and sometimes it's not when it comes to Afghanistan. And the president has said he was going to put significant new pressure on Pakistan. Can you explain that to the committee? What he meant?
I can, Senator Nelson. The pressure will be, let's put it in optimistic terms, so that they can see where their interests converge with the international community at stopping terrorism. And again, they have lost probably more troops than any other single country in the fight against terrorism. At the same time, we have seen havens left to the terrorists' own devices. We have seen the government of Pakistan come down on terrorism while ISI appears to run its own foreign policy. So what we're going to do is working with the international community and the South Asia neighboring nations plus China, Russia, looking for common ground with all of these nations and the 39 troop contributing nations that include NATO plus NATO's partners. We're going to work to have a very firm list of what has got to change. And then using diplomatic and economic means, having venues where we share the way ahead with each other, we're going to try to get this to a productive outcome. Right now, based on a very recent visit by the Chief of Army Staff from Pakistan, there is actually optimism in Kabul that his visit presages a new chapter. I'm in the we'll see mode, but we intend to bring all the effort we can in a whole of government, international framed way to Islamabad and show them how to get out of the situation they're currently in.
Thank you.
On behalf of Chairman Senator Warren, please.
Thank you, Ranking Member Reed. And
you're listening to the Senate Armed Service Committee hearing that so much news came out of in the last 24 hours. In fact, as I was talking, when you go through the early bird, just about every major story that comes out of the early bird today comes out of this hearing, as you can see. Again, illuminating not only, it's supposed to be about Afghanistan, but you can see it's about North Korea, it's about Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. Just in terms of disaster relief, the president, gets a lot of shit. But much of initial disaster relief has to come from the local people to tell you what you need. It's not simply we have a set that's ready to go. I mean, that set has to be tailored for what you need. Do you need, more generators? Do you need more water production? What exactly do you need? And so it'll be interesting in the postmortem to see where the actual delay was, because the president honestly doesn't have a whole lot to do with it. Okay? Maybe it didn't hit his Twitter feed often enough, and he could be held accountable for that. Maybe he should have dialed down the NFL tweets and dialed up the Puerto Rico tweets. That would have made everybody happier. But in terms of the actual what happens, as Secretary Mattis just said, we had already activated people. We already designated people to go. All right, and that had happened before. We've activated additional people as different requests have come in for different capabilities, and those people are now either en route or already there. And so, I think you see that FEMA, and again, I've seen FEMA not do good things. FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security, everybody should get down and kiss their ass for what they've done in succession, right? Houston and the Louisiana, coast right there, the Texas-Louisiana coast extending into Houston. They had that going on. Then they get South Florida, they get the Virgin Islands, and they get Puerto Rico. Boom, 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 boom. And so, hats off. And you get some kind of sense of 10,000 U.S. active duty and reservists in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands right now. So we'll continue to listen to this. The questioning is almost done. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat, next.
And thank you, Secretary Mattis and General Dunford, for your work and for being here. In August, the president released his new Afghan strategy, and a key part of it seems to be the idea that the military will use all of its tools, that the U.S. will use all of its tools, military, economic, and diplomatic, to get the Taliban to the negotiating table. In fact, the Pentagon's release says, and I want to quote it, We will bolster the fighting strength of government forces to convince the Taliban they cannot win on the battlefield. This will set conditions for the ultimate goal of our strategy, a peace settlement between the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban that protects our interests. Now, for some of us, this strategy seems like deja vu all over again. So I just have a straightforward question on this. Secretary Mattis, can you explain to me how you will, quote, convince the Taliban they cannot win on the battlefield when 16 years of evidence suggests otherwise?
Well, the point we're making is, ma'am, that the change to a conditions-based means we set the conditions, we bolster, to use the word that you just quoted there, we bolster the Afghan fighting forces' capability so that the Taliban find they cannot kill their way to power, is the bottom line. It's going to be a fight. We've already seen difficulties in the Taliban's campaign. For example, they're still trying to take down provincial and district centers. They've been unable to do so. For the first time in 16 years, six Afghan army corps are on the offensive. We've never had all six of them work at the same time. So you see, that is the way we drive the enemy to the understanding they cannot wait us out. Before, they could wait us out. They always knew what the timeline was for withdrawal. They kept sensing we were leaving.
We've had multiple strategies where people come in and tell us we're using a different military strategy, we're using a different military strategy, and this time it's going to work. I don't think I can count how many times that's happened in 16 years. Mm-hmm. But the part you're focused on now is that part right at the end that says they can't wait us out. And that's what bothers me, because what it seems to be saying is that the Trump administration's plan to force the Taliban to the negotiating table is to say, we are willing to continue to fight the Afghan war forever. And that just can't be right. It can't.
Well, so, we're not fighting the Afghan war, ma'am. Again, we're not going to supplant or substitute our troops for the 320,000 Afghan troops whose, fortunately, their casualties are going down now while Taliban's are going up. We are going to assist them in fighting this war, and we're not going to put a timeline on it that the Taliban then gets hope that we can wait them out.
But with respect, Mr. Secretary, you're talking about having our troops in Afghanistan in harm's way mm-hmm. forever. And
no,
that can't be right. You're saying that's the key to this.
Well, the point is not forever, because we're saying you can't wait us out. Now, the way you win this, it's a matter of will. It is not, certainly we may have advisors there 10 years from now, but the Taliban will not be the enemy they are. Pulling out, I am convinced, would imperil the people of Massachusetts and California.
I understand that that's your position on this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very concerned that the central change seems to be, we'll wait them out, which is an open-ended commitment that sounds a lot like the word forever to me. Let me ask you about one other thing from that statement. The statement says that we're going to have a negotiated settlement that, quote, protects our interests. Can you just say a word, Mr. Secretary, about what that means?
That means that transnational attacks on the United States would not occur. That's in our interest. We don't be attacked. As we saw coming out of that area on 9/11. And furthermore, the way you do that is helping the Afghan people to have a security force that defends them so they don't have these kind of attacks germinating in their mountains coming against New York City.
And we're going to do this through negotiations. Secretary Mattis, we've now been in Afghanistan for 16 years. 2,386 brave Americans have died. More than 20,000 have been wounded. More than 100,000 Afghans have been killed. We have spent nearly $1 trillion. And after all of that, The Afghan forces still lack the ability to stand on their own. The government controls less than 60% of their territory. They control only a third of their population. The UN reported that opium production in Afghanistan rose 43% last year alone. Endemic corruption continues with no signs of diminishing. Fewer than half of Afghans support the Afghan unity government. I understand the need to prevent Afghanistan from once again becoming a safe haven for terrorist groups. And I very much appreciate the work you're doing and your coming here today, Mr. Secretary. But as best I can tell, this new strategy is just more of the same, except we've removed the timetables because we have little hope of success within any identified time period.
Senator, we have removed the timetable that gave hope to the Taliban. At the same time, we are going to give support and advice and assistance at a level in the Afghan military that for all the casualties they took, they were not as effective as they could have been. So by making them more effective, the Afghan military will worsen the situation the Taliban face, and we will be ready to talk at any point. But it's the same conditions that Secretary Clinton established for the Taliban. Stop killing people, stop supporting international terrorists, and live by the Constitution. That's a pretty low bar that we're driving toward, and it'll be Afghan-led reconciliation is where we're going.
And I just say with respect, yes, it is a very low bar that we're driving toward, and we're losing.
I would disagree with the last point, ma'am.
Well, all I know is to look at the numbers. And the drug trade is up. Corruption is up. There's no support for the government. And more people keep dying. And we keep hearing our generals come in here and tell us over and over, just give us one more military plan and it's going to work. And it's just hard to buy that. And it's hard to buy it on behalf of the people who go put their lives at risk.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thanks, Senator Warren. Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony and for your service. And on behalf of Chairman McCain, I will adjourn the hearing. Thank you.
Senator Elizabeth Warren saying that she's not buying it. So we'll take a quick break. We'll check news headlines. I've got a couple emails about that. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on a Wednesday edition. Right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't touch that dial.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled machine anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsouthfoundation.org/marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
.48 on hump day. President of the United States just arrived in Las Vegas. He'll be there, meeting with different groups of people in the wake of the shootings there Sunday night. So, see if there's any news that comes out of that. Top five stories on the early bird today. Number one, Senate won't confirm Trump's Pentagon nominees until Senator McCain gets Iraq and Afghanistan details. So, again, you just finished listening to the Senate Armed Service Committee that came out of. That was part of the wire brushing that Senator McCain gave to the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff relative to the information that he believes that they need to make decisions relative to funding and things like that. So. Also, I need to get my boy Knowles on. But Secretary Mattis revealed that the United States is now working under new rules of engagement, latitude that the president gave to the Secretary of Defense, and expected him to change it. So the article's in Defense News. Changes allow the U.S. military to move more quickly to defeat terrorist organizations. Rules of engagement are classified. Military officials generally do not discuss them. However, there were signs that the changes of those rules of engagement were coming. The president alluded to that there would be modification to the rules of engagement. Secretary of Defense has taken that authority and implemented at least two changes: the removal of proximity requirements for strikes against Taliban forces. That means some American had to be in proximity in order for the, for us to strike them, and the spreading out of U.S. and allied advisors to lower level Afghan units. So, he talked about it yesterday in the Senate Armed Service Committee testimony, but I'll quote it. You see some of the results releasing our military from, for example, a proximity requirement. How close was the enemy to the Afghan or U.S. advised special forces? That is no longer the case. For example, these kinds of restrictions that did not allow us to employ the air power fully have been removed. So if they're not in proximity to U.S. forces, right, you could not engage them. Now, if you identify them, you can engage them. So if there's an assembly area, a training camp, we know that the enemy is using, and they're going to threaten the Afghan government and the Afghan people. General Nicholson, who's the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, has the wherewithal to make that decision. The second change involves essentially dispersing U.S. advisors among Afghan units that are close to enemy forces. Those units with NATO and American advisors win, and those units without those advisors don't win as often. So we're going to spread the number of units with advisors to bring that air support and win. Asked to expand on that subject, Mattis described the change as now being able to bring the fire support to bear where we could not before, whether it be for proximity or because we were not with those units. So by dispersing the number of controllers, obviously you can be more effective. So those two things are not small events tactically. So the Secretary of Defense talking about them yesterday. And then also, families and a congressman file a lawsuit in the deadly Osprey crash from 2000. That's a Military Times story, and the widows are widows of two Marine Corps pilots killed in an MV-22 Osprey crash in 2000. And a congressman who has pursued answers about the incident for years announced that they have filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the DOD to obtain additional documents. We'll see if we can get one of them on the program. And the representative is Walter Jones from North Carolina. Jones said the lawsuit was necessary after he filed a Freedom of Information Act request earlier this year to get documents on the crash, and the DOD provided just a single page that was heavily redacted with none of the answers he sought. The crash occurred in April of 2000 at Marana Regional Airport in Arizona, killing 19 Marines. After a subsequent Osprey crash that year, the program was temporarily put on hold for additional development and testing. So, anyway, so that in the news. Jalal Talabani, the Kurdish leader who used pragmatism, guile, and an outsized personality to navigate a hazardous course in Middle East politics, surviving guerrilla war, the terrors of Saddam Hussein, and shifting balances to become the first president of Iraq under its post-war constitution, if you can imagine that. He was a Kurd. Died on Tuesday in Berlin. He was 83. And then in the top five stories, the last one is the first female AAV officer graduated with her class at Amphibious Assault School. So she will be reporting to the Fleet Marine Force. Her name is Second Lieutenant Mariah Klenke. Quote, and this is in Marine Corps Times, we're going over all of the MOSs and amphibious assault vehicles popped up, and to me it just stuck out. You get to keep the Marine Corps amphibious. You're still working with the infantry. The tracks are pretty sweet. And yesterday morning, she earned the military occupational specialty of 1803. For assault amphibian officer when she graduated with her class at Camp Pendleton. She'll now participate headed for the Fleet Marine Force. So congratulations to her. Again, you know, people don't believe this, but there's enough professionals in the Marine Corps. If you can do the work, have at it. Socially, we'll adjust. Socially, we'll adjust. Just don't change the standard on us. And I think you've heard that ad nauseum. A couple of the stories before we go today on this Wednesday. And again, Major League Baseball playoffs tonight. Don't miss them. Yeah. So in case you're not paying attention, Colorado and Arizona play a winner-take-all game. All right. U.S. Missile Defense gets another $400 million. You heard the Secretary of Defense talking about that in his testimony. U.S.-North Korea back-channel talks are happening. So that's what Secretary of Defense was alluding to in his statement yesterday. And then a few Marine Corps headlines. Marine vet steals a truck, saves dozens during Las Vegas massacre. Marine Corps veteran Taylor Winston was attending a concert with his girlfriend at the Las Vegas Route 91 Harvest Country Music Festival when shots rang out. Rather than get out of harm's way, the Iraq veteran stole a truck, transported dozens of injured to the hospital, CBS News reported. The shots got louder and louder, closer to us, saw people getting hit. It was like we could get hit any second, Winston said in a CBS interview. Once we got to the fence, I helped throw a bunch of people over and got myself over. It was a mini war zone, but we couldn't fight back. I saw a field with a bunch of white trucks. I tested my luck to see if any of them had keys in it. First one I tried opening had keys right there. I started looking for people to take to the hospital. There was just too many, and it was overwhelming how much blood was there. After transporting the first truckload of victims to the hospital, Winston went back for more. He estimates he transported between 20 and 30 people to the hospital. I think a lot of my training in the military helped me in that situation. We needed to get them out of there regardless of safety. Winston enlisted in the Marine Corps at the age of 17, twice deployed to Iraq. He was honorably discharged in 2011. He returned the keys to the truck owner Monday night, according to CBS. Nice. Well done. Somehow or other fitting stealing a truck. Stealing a truck to make that happen. Good on him. We'll see if we can get him on too. You know, it's interesting. You know, you see these stories and tracking people down, whether it's the lawsuit relative to the Osprey, or whether it's tracking, you know, with LinkedIn and Facebook. It's not hard to find most people. You know, now some people don't participate, but the vast majority of people, you can track them down in one of those vehicles. So you'll hopefully hear from them. If they'll do interviews with Marine Corps Times, come on, you know they'll come on All Marine Radio. It's way more fun. That'll do it on a hump day. If you're just tuning in late to the program, let me tell you what you're going to hear. Mike Musselman joins us, and we have a little bit of a discussion. One of the things I love to do here is explain. So Gunnar comes on and explains what this thing, the bump stock, is, and the difference acoustically that you would hear in a bump stock and what you would hear when somebody modifies a sear. Modifying a sear gets you a fully automatic weapon that's going to sound universal and uniform. And that's what you hear in some of the audio that we played initially. And then later on, though, Ohio Man chimed in and said, yeah, later on you'll hear irregular shot patterns. That would be the bump stock. So I've never used a bump stock, but I will accept those two. Both of them are gun guys. So you'll hear about that. John Ubaldi, we talk a little bit of current events. The Secretary of State in a little bit of drama. NBC broke a story that said that he called the president a moron in a meeting at the Pentagon. Now, I don't know. They don't quote anybody directly, and it doesn't say that the people that were their sources heard the comments themselves. So anyway, the Secretary of State took it upon himself to clear the air. Ultimately, when he was asked directly if he made those comments, he said he wasn't going to comment about that, which normally, if you didn't say it, you would normally come out and say, I didn't say it. Those are lies. He didn't say that. So, but it is reminiscent of something that has been a thing in the past in the White House since General Kelly got there, which is the constant leaks. So you have people attending those meetings leaking to, you know, the arguments and the private comments people make. And so Rex Tillerson, let that be a lesson if you said it. But again, I find it hard. Secretary Tillerson, such a polished guy. He was president of the Boy Scouts, for God's sakes. Doesn't mean he can't say it. But these guys tend to be polished people in public, especially when there's jackasses around that they don't even know. Aides and whatnot, they're the leakers. The principals aren't doing it. Well, I guess Nixon did a little bit. But anyway, on Wednesday, thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon. All Marine Radio, over and out.